Today we're going to do the second part of the incentives lecture, and the key point for our discussion today is the point of performance measurement. So today we're going to be talking a lot about performance measurement and the role of performance measurement in determining the optimal incentive scheme. So I would like to start with the last slide that we did last lecture, and the topic here was to address the question of efficiency of the linear incentive scheme. So here's a linear incentive scheme, and when it's implemented in the environment where effort is not observed and when agent is not risk neutral, is it efficient or not? Compare it with the situation in which the agent is risk neutral. When the agent is risk neutral, how should the linear incentive pay scheme look like? You know it from the Personnel Economics 1 course that we did in the winter semester. Back there, we derived the formula for the optimal strength of incentives, and what it implied was that the optimal strength of incentives should be such that the agent should appropriate the entire output that he produces and pay to the principal a fee for being able to do the job, which is a rather strange arrangement. It is observed at times, but not all the time. Taxi drivers is a classical example here. But now we're in the world of not only an observable effort, we're also in the world of the agent being not risk neutral, agent being typically risk averse. Now, if the agent is risk averse, the price of bearing risk under linear incentives will enter the agent's participation constraint. And through the participation constraint, the price of bearing risk will be added to the fixed wage that the principal chooses to pay to the agent. Now, because the principal is paying more money to the agent in the form of fixed wage as a price for bearing risk, the optimal strength of incentives under this scheme for a risk-averse agent should be strictly below one. So a risk-averse agent will always get less than what he produces, but in exchange to this and as an insurance against a possible decrease in earnings because of a particularly unlucky event, the agent will always be guaranteed a certain fixed level of wage that the principal will pay him no matter what. And the question is this arrangement efficient in terms of risk sharing? We know that it's not efficient in terms of the total welfare, right? Because we know that the incentive scheme that is efficient in terms of the total welfare is the incentive scheme in which the agent gets all the output and pays money to the principal. So a negative fixed wage, strength of incentives equal one. But here, there is another margin of inefficiency, which has to do with the costs of bearing risk. So the linear incentive pay scheme is not efficient not only in terms of strength of incentives, it's also not efficient in terms of the risk sharing. You may recall from the previous lecture that efficient risk sharing implies that the total risk in a contract between the principal and agent should be borne in proportion to the risk tolerance. In particular, if you have a risk neutral principal and a risk averse agent, the risk neutral principal should efficiently, in the efficient case, be bearing the entire risk of the transaction, because the costs of bearing risk for the principal are strictly zero. The principal is risk neutral after all. However, if the principal is going to bear all the risk from the incentive pay contract, this implies that the strength of incentives, performance related incentives for the agent should be zero, and that in turn implies that the optimal effort exerted by the agent will be zero, which is not efficient either. So we strike a trade-off On the one hand, we want the agent to encourage the trader, to encourage to put in effort. On the other hand, we don't want the agent to bear too much risk. But the fact that the agent bears some risk through the share of output that he receives as part of incentive pay means that the agent is bearing too much risk and the principal is bearing too little risk to render the risk bearing under linear incentives efficient. So, again, bearing risk, more expensive for agent, less expensive for the principal. In the optimum, the principal should therefore bear all risk because it's free for him, and yet the agent bears some of the risk through incentives, which is suboptimal, not efficient. So we are not in the first best here. We are in the second best because the agent is bearing some risk. The question before us, the next question before us is, can we do anything in order to make a linear incentive contract or any incentive contract more, not necessarily linear, more efficient in terms of bearing risks? In other words, can we design incentives in such a way that the agent would bear less risk? And the answer is yes, we can. We can't make it fully efficient, so that's out of the question. As long as the agent is not risk neutral, there is no talking about efficiency, but we can make it less inefficient. And there are several ways in which we can do so. One group of ways is about introducing some non-linearities into the incentive scheme by way of, say, performance targets or some convexities in the incentive scheme, which is very difficult and we're not going to cover it in this bachelor level course. What we are going to cover is a reduction in the risk that the agent bears through more accurate, more precise measurement of performance. So, look here. This is the optimal strength of incentives. I hope you recall this formula from the previous lecture. The optimal strength of incentives depends positively on the marginal product of the agent's effort, and it depends negatively on the amount of risk that the agent has to bear. Where does this risk come from? This risk comes from the imperfectly measured effort. You don't observe agent's effort. What you do observe is some measure of performance, which is effort plus some noise. And the variance of this noise, sigma squared, introduces the risk to the agent, which the agent requires some compensation for the costs of bearing, because the agent, notice, is not risk neutral but risk averse. So this risk aversion coefficient is positive. Right? So you could make the agent happier and you could increase the strength of incentives by somehow reducing the sigma squared. And that means more precise measurement of output. It's also good for the principal to measure output more precisely, because if the principal measures output more precisely, this variance of the random noise component in the performance measure is going to be less. That therefore the optimal strength of incentives should be more. With the higher optimal strength of incentives, the agent's effort is higher. The agent's effort being higher means more output created for the principal, and as long as the agent's effort is below the efficient level of effort, more precise performance measurement will make both the principal and the agent both better off. The agent, by reducing his costs of bearing risk, the principal, by increasing the profit that he can derive from employing the agent. However, what we haven't considered so far in anywhere in our derivations, either today or last week, is the costs of measuring performance. So far, we've assumed that there is some kind of performance measure which is given to us, which is somehow recorded and costlessly analyzed and transmitted from the point of measurement to the point of paying cash to the agent. That's, of course, not the case. Right? Performance measurement is one of the activities carried out in all organizations, and this activity is notoriously, it can get quite costly. Right? So how do you measure performance? What is the typical way of measuring performance? You have a performance review, let's say each year or even each quarter, like some tech companies do. You ask the agent to fill in the form. You appoint someone who would assess the performance of the agent given the form. You will have a performance review meeting and goal setting meeting and the control meeting, etc. There are fat books written on how to measure performance, and there are special people employed in various HR consultancies whose only job it is to come up with ways of measuring performance. So it's a veritable industry, performance measurement, and performance measurement is costly. And it turns out that the more precisely you want to measure performance, the more money you've got to pay for it. So given that we can increase the strength of incentives by reducing sigma squared, the naive question can be, well, can we come up with a super precise performance measure that will reduce sigma squared to zero, will create super strong incentives, and everybody will be super happy? No, because what this logic doesn't take into account is that if you want to reduce the precision, if you want to reduce the noise with which you measure agents' performance, it's going to cost you increasingly more. And these costs will have to be set against whatever gains in terms of profit you will get through being able to offer stronger incentives. This is basically the idea behind a theoretical result known in the literature as the so-called monitoring intensity principle. So monitoring intensity principle. Let's get back to my naive question. You know, can we measure performance super precisely so as to have sigma squared next to zero and super strong incentives and super efficient outcomes? Not always, because measuring performance is costly. So then a more realistic, less naive question is, what is the best measure of performance? So you can have a very crude, very noisy measure of performance, sometimes even biased measure of performance, right, which has huge sigma squared, and therefore optimally low strength of incentives on the one hand. On the other hand, you can have a super precise measure of performance with very low sigma squared, but it's going to cost you a fortune. Which one do you choose? Yeah? And the monitoring incentive principle states that there is a trade-off. There is a trade-off between the benefits from the strength of incentives and the costs of higher precision in terms of performance measurement. And this trade-off implies that there exists an optimal level of monitoring intensity. There exists an optimal level of costs and precision of the performance measurement technique that firms should optimally implement. Let's have a look at how it works. This is the total profit from employing the agent. So a level of effort E generates output P of E, and then the principal will have to pay the agent's wage, which is equal to the cost of effort plus the risk premium. Okay, and then there is another component which so far is not there, so far hasn't been there. This is the first time we're introducing it. And this component has to do with the cost of measuring performance. So this function M of sigma squared is a function that maps a certain precision of measurement performance into the costs of achieving this precise measure of performance. And you know, it's easy to see that M of sigma squared goes down with sigma squared, so you can have a more lousy measure of performance with larger sigma squared at a lower cost. But if you want very low sigma squared, you're going to have to pay a lot of money for it. So you have M prime, the marginal costs of measuring performance going down with sigma squared, and M 2 prime is positive in the sense that the costs of measuring performance are convex in terms of the noisiness of this performance. So in other words, if you want to get more and more and more precise, less and less and less noisy measure of performance, you have to pay increasingly more for it. Now, the monitoring intensity principle says, okay, there is a trade-off between the gains from higher from more precise performance measurement and the costs of this more precise performance measurement, which imply the optimal level of precision of performance measurement. How do we get this optimal level of precision of performance measurement? Well, we maximize the principal's profit, this time not with respect to effort. The effort is a function of how precisely you measure performance. This time you maximize this with respect to sigma squared, the noise that your particular performance measurement technique has. So these are the marginal benefits of higher sigma squared. So it's a negative. If your performance measure has to be noisier, you're going to pay this much as a risk premium to the agent. And these are the marginal costs of more precise performance measurement. So this is a negative component, this is a positive component, because remember, the derivative of the cost of measurement function with respect to the noise is negative. So negative times minus is positive. So you could solve this equation in terms of sigma squared, and the solution, this equation in terms of sigma squared, will determine the optimal profit maximizing precision with which you measure performance given the strength of incentives. Okay, so if you want to operate strong incentives, if you really want to have super motivated personnel, if you want to pay them lots of money in terms of incentive pay, your beta should be large. But then, if your beta is large, your sigma squared should be small. So you're going to have to pay more money to maximize profit under a given strength of incentives. That's what monitoring intensity principle states. I hope it's intuitive for you. If not, I am available for your questions and comments as usual. Now, I don't like this result. It's mathematically correct, but I don't like it. Why don't I like it? Because it's naive. What it says is, given that you've chosen strength of incentives, you've got to choose the optimal degree of performance measurement. What's so naive about it? Well, the naivete of this argument is that, well, look, you are the boss, you are the principal. You can choose the strength of incentives and the precision with which you measure performance simultaneously. These are both your decision parameters. It's not like you get some kind of rule or regulation regarding how strong your incentives should be. This is your policy. And it's not that you get some rule or regulation about how precise your performance measurement should be. This is, again, your policy. So both beta, strength of incentives, and sigma squared, the imprecision with which you measure performance, are determined simultaneously, right? So if you have beta and sigma determined simultaneously, you need to have two first-order conditions. You need to have two equations from which you determine these two variables, right? And these two equations are this. So the optimal strength of incentives is a function of how precisely you measure performance. And the optimal measure, the optimal precision of your performance measure is a function of the strength of incentives. So these are two equations which can be solved simultaneously with respect to beta and sigma squared in order to find the optimal sigma squared and the optimal beta that will together, chosen together, maximize the profit of the principal. Now, you could do it as a you could do comparative statics on these two equations to obtain some intuitive and yet mildly interesting results. For instance, one result you could obtain from doing comparative statics on these equations is that both the strength of incentives and performance precision will increase with the productivity of effort. So if the agent's effort is super productive, which means that the marginal product of agent's effort is very high, you need to incentivize these people very strongly, and you need to measure their performance very precisely. Right? So whereas if the agent is not that productive, you simply don't care. You don't want to spend too much money on measuring the level of performance, which is matched with rather low incentives because this person is not very productive. So in some occupations you have very strong incentives and very, very tight ways, precise ways with which performance is measured. Whereas in other occupations, you don't have very strong incentives to start with. People are not super productive. The difference that people make with their effort to the overall performance of the organization is not very large. Therefore, it's not worth spending a lot of resources on monitoring the activity of such people. So this is the sort of outcome of the monitoring intensity principle. You could do similar exercises on the costs of effort and the risk aversion. So that would be an interesting exercise as well. I am in the process of preparing tutorial questions for the tutorial on incentives. Oh, you've had a tutorial incentive already, right? Did you have tutorial incentives? Okay, next year then. I'll put it in the questions bank. Well, that was a nice talk relevant to the monitoring intensity principle. I wish our online friends were here to participate, but here we are. Now, so where are we? So far, we've just said, okay, there is a trade-off between strength of incentives and the benefits and costs of strength of incentives, which trade-off is resolved by simultaneously choosing the strength of incentives and the degree of precision with which you want to measure performance. So what will it give you? It will give you the optimal, not strictly not zero, just the optimal sigma squared, the optimal imprecision with which you measure performance, and the optimal strength of incentives that corresponds to the imprecision with which you measure performance. Can you further improve efficiency? So you can improve efficiency by choosing the optimal sigma squared and beta. Can you further improve efficiency? Yes, you can. That's why you have so many people doing incentives, so many consultancies doing incentives, so many literature written on incentives, because it's not something that you can, you know, do very easily or undo very easily. There are many different things that you can do in the world of incentives. Now, one such thing is you can incorporate additional information into how you measure performance. So far, we have assumed up until now that there is one particular measure of performance. Remember, this was the measure of performance, Z, which is equal to the agent's effort plus some random noise term. Now the question is, why don't we have 2, 3, 17 measures of performance? Is it going to help? The answer is yes. The more information you use in order to measure performance, the more precise signal you can get about the agent's effort, the more precise signal you can get about the agent's effort, the stronger are the incentives that you can offer to the agent, the higher your profit is going to be, and the higher welfare your principal agent economy will enjoy. That brings us to a thing called the informativeness principle. So what is the informativeness principle? Informativeness principle says that whenever there is more information, more measures available to assess the agent's performance with, you should use these measures. So a typical situation, you have an account manager, a key account manager who works with a particular customer, and you want to incentivize this key account manager by offering them a bonus or a piece rate depending on the amount of turnover that this account generates. So you use one performance measure to incentivize the agent, which is basically the sales that this agent generates through this account. But there's other measures of the key account manager's performance. One such measure is quality, right? So it's not only the amount of sales that this key account generates, but also customer service feedback that this key account generates, right? Similarly, a professor should be judged not only by the number of papers, articles that they publish, but also by how good they are at teaching. This has a double significance spoken by me, who has not enjoyed very high student evaluations statistics so far. But the informativeness principle says is that whatever information you have, in order to estimate available, useful to estimate the agent's performance with, you should use it. You should use every additional indicator about the agent's effort that is freely available, as long as this indicator is informative. So here's a major provision, right? As long as this indicator is informative of the agent's actual effort, you should use it. The weather indicator is available. Should you use it? No, because it's not informative of the principle of the agent's effort. So that distinguishes the informativeness. What is informativeness? What is informative? The notion of informativeness is best illustrated with examples. Right? So we will learn about what informative is from the following two examples, example one and example two, and then we will try to generalize, then try to sort of define what informative means, because there's no clear, easy definition of it. There is a formal definition, which is very clear but not very easy. It has to do with the notion of sufficient statistic, which you may or may not know from your previous training. So here's one example of the informativeness principle. Let's go back to the simple example that we had before. Very simple example, and this example has a well-known solution for the strength of incentives. Now, let's make this example more interesting by allowing, in addition to the performance measure Z, let's allow another performance indicator I. So in addition to, say, sales that your key account manager generates, you also collect customer service feedback from this key account. So you have two indicators of the agent's effort. And the question is, should you use the information about the additional indicator or not? So this additional indicator is a function of the agent's effort. It's noisy. It's not precise. There is a noise epsilon, which may or may not be correlated with the noise in the performance measure Z. Now, when it's correlated, the maths become a little bit more complicated without offering us any further insights or little further insight. Therefore, I am presenting this example under the assumption that these two indicators have noise components that are totally uncorrelated with each other. So, in other words, so if we have two performance indicators, should we use both or should we use just one? Here's a question. It turns out that we should use both performance indicators, Z and I. How do I know? Well, I know it from repeating the analysis behind this example I hope you recall from the previous lecture. You can just redo this. The only difference is that now your wage scheme contains the incentives based on performance indicator Z, as well as the incentives based on performance indicator I. So you have two measures of performance. You get, €1,000 bonus for every million that you generate, for every million euros that you generate on your account. And you get, a €500 bonus for good or bad customer service report. Okay. And you get, of course, a fixed wage. So solving the optimal incentives, the optimal incentive design problem for this wage scheme, you get the following solutions for the optimal strength of incentives with respect to performance indicator Z and the optimal strength of incentives with respect to the performance indicator I. Try to do this at home. Do try to do this at home. It's an excellent practice for your exam. Now, look here. This is the optimal strength of incentives with respect to performance indicator Z. Compare this expression with what it used to be when Z was the only performance indicator available to you. It looks different, doesn't it? It has the variance of the performance measure I in it, okay, it looks different. Also, look at the optimal strength of incentives with respect to performance measure I. Is it equal to zero? No, it's not equal to zero, right? It's not equal, well, it's not always equal to zero. Unless this parameter is infinite, it will be equal to zero. But in general, it's not equal to zero. What does it mean? Both these guys, this guy not equal to what it was when Z was the only performance indicator, and this guy not equal to zero, together mean that an optimal decision maker, the principal in making decisions about the optimal strength of incentives, should incorporate information about performance measure I in his optimal incentive design. So it's not optimal to just ignore information about performance measure I. If it were optimal to ignore information about performance measure I, then performance measure I would not be part of the optimal incentive scheme. Beta I would simply be equal to zero. But because beta I is not equal to zero, it means that you should use information about the performance measure I in designing the optimal incentive scheme. Now, the solution of this problem is not particularly interesting, except for one extreme case or two extreme cases. And one of these cases goes back to the notion of informative. What do we mean by informative? Right? So by informative, as I said, the notion of informative we're going to illustrate with two examples. Informative meaning basically that a given measure of performance is sufficient statistic for the effort, which it never is. In this particular example, suppose indicator I has a very, very large variance. So it's a very bad measure of the agent's effort, right? So because indicator I has a very large variance, it's a very bad measure of the agent's effort, okay? The variance of the noise to this indicator, sigma squared epsilon, is going to be very, very large. Now, if you take a limit of these expressions, when sigma squared epsilon approaches infinity, then this in the limit, the optimal strength of incentives with respect to Z will converge to this result, and the optimal strength of incentives with respect to I will converge to zero. So what this result means? It means that if you cannot reliably measure the agent's effort, if you cannot reliably measure the agent's effort from performance indicator I, if your variance, if the variance of this performance indicator I is very large or infinite, then this performance indicator I is not informative. It's not informative in the sense that you're not going to learn anything about the agent's effort by observing I. It's like trying to learn about my effort by observing weather. Right? If that's the case, if indicator I is not informative, the optimal strength of incentive with respect to performance indicator I should be equal to zero. So you shouldn't use it at all. If, however, it's informative, which means that it's noisy, but its noise is not infinite, right? You should use it, and the strength of incentives with respect to performance indicator I should be the higher, the smaller the variance of this indicator, or the smaller the variance of the noise in this indicator is. If this indicator is very precise, sigma squared epsilon is going to be low. If sigma squared epsilon is going to be low, beta I, the optimal strength of incentive with respect to performance indicator I, will be high. And so you should use this information more. If it's noisy, you should use it less. If it's less noisy, you should base more incentive pay on this. Okay? So, make sense? Okay, let's move on. Now, another example of the notion of informativeness is the following. So suppose now that there is a performance indicator I, the same idea, the same story as before, except with very important exception, that performance indicator I doesn't measure A's effort at all. So performance indicator I is not a function of the agent's effort. It's just some kind of noise, right? So once again, it used to be like this. Performance indicator I is related to the effort, and this relationship is disturbed by noise epsilon. What we are considering now is a situation in which I is just noise, not has nothing to do with effort. Question is, can we use this very strange indicator, which has nothing to do with the agent's effort, in the optimal design of the incentive schemes for this particular agent? Can we or can we not? Well, we can. At least sometimes we can. And let us first do the maths, and then we will try to give intuitions to this maths. So suppose we now want to devise an incentive scheme that will incorporate information about both performance indicator Z and performance indicator I. So here is your performance indicator Z, which enters with the coefficient beta. And here is your performance indicator I, which enters into the incentive scheme with the coefficients beta times gamma. So it's a slight reparameterization compared to the example one, but the idea is the same. You have an incentive scheme which is linearly dependent on both performance indicators Z and performance indicators I, right? And here is a comment. Why not? Why can't we have this incentive scheme? Sure, we can. If it's not optimal, then the coefficient gamma will be just zero and we've had it. But it turns out that the optimal coefficient gamma is not always zero. Right? If the noise terms in the performance indicator Z and the noise term in performance indicator I are correlated with each other, right, then it's going to have an effect on the price that the principal has to pay to the agent for bearing risk. Because now your variance of earnings is not only the function of the variance of the noise in the performance measure Z, it's not only the function of this guy, it's also the function of noise in the performance measure I. Okay? Now, opening the brackets and simplifying gives us the following expression. The variance of the noise of the agent's earnings is equal to the variance of the noise in the measure of performance Z, our familiar sigma squared, plus the coefficient gamma squared times the variance of performance indicator I, okay, plus, remember the formula for the variance of two random variables, it's equal to the sum of the variance plus twice the covariance, here's your twice the covariance. Now the question is, can you improve the optimality, can you improve the efficiency of an incentive scheme by including information about I? The answer is yes, because you can, by including the information about I, you can minimize the risk that the agent has to bear as part of this incentive scheme. So what should be the optimal value of the parameter gamma with which performance indicator I enters into the incentives function? What should it be in order to minimize the variance of earnings? Taking the first order condition from this function gives us the following expression. Minus covariance divided by variance. What is it? Looks like correlation. It's not quite correlation, but it has to do with correlation. Right? So what is this? If there is a correlation between our measure of performance that we use to reward the agent and another indicator I, which has nothing to do with the agent effort, we can use this information in order to minimize the variance of agent's earnings. So if it's not zero, then this thing will not be zero and the optimal gamma will not be zero. If there is no correlation between the shock, between the noise in our measure of performance Z and the other measure I, then this covariance is going to be zero and we should optimally not use performance indicator I in our incentive scheme. So to get back to my question, should you use the information about weather to determine the strength of incentives, to incentivize my performance? Should you use this information or not? Yes?
Okay.
So whether you should use information about the weather in determining my incentives depends on whether the noise in my performance measure is correlated with the weather or not. Couple of examples. Suppose you're an ice cream salesperson and the number of ice creams, the amount of ice cream that you sell is a function of your effort, your customer service effort, and some random noise. You have lucky days, you have less lucky days. And if it turns out that your lucky days are correlated with the weather, then you should use this information. And of course, your lucky days are correlated with the weather, because when the weather is fine, you can sell lots of ice cream with the same effort. Whereas when the weather is bad, it doesn't matter how hard you work to attract customers, you're going to sell very little. Okay? So if you don't use information about the weather, if you pay the agent a certain amount of money for every 1,000 euros that this person generates by selling ice cream, then because of the noise in the amount of ice cream that you sell and the risk that the agent has to bear given this noise, the agent should get a higher fixed wage and a lower incentive strength. But then, if you say, oh, I'm going to take the weather into account. When the weather is fine, I'm going to reduce your... I'm going to take this information into account, and the information about the weather is going to enter with a negative coefficient into your wage. So your wage would then be... fixed wage plus some big coefficient on the amount of ice cream that you sell, minus some smaller coefficient on the weather. So good weather punishes you, bad weather rewards you. Does it make sense? Well, psychologically, to some people it may not make sense, but economically it makes a lot of sense. Because look, if the weather is fine, you're going to sell a lot. So you don't mind being punished by good weather, because you know that you're going to sell a lot when the weather is good. On the other hand, when the weather is nasty, you're going to be rewarded for the nasty weather. Even though weather has nothing to do with you, but it does. Because this gives you a sort of insurance. This gives you a sort of additional certainty. It gives you a reduction in the variance of the financial risk that you bear from receiving your pay dependent on the amount of ice cream sold alone, without any reference to the weather. Another example, we did this in Personnel Economics 1, if you may remember. Another example is whether you should use a relative performance evaluation or absolute performance evaluation. The same story. Consider a bunch of agents, each of them working on their own, so there's no teamwork, nothing, except that the incentives for every agent is a function of not only this agent's output, but also a function of the average output of the other agents. And we found, we demonstrated in Personnel Economics 1 course, that when the individual performances of the agents are correlated with each other positively, then the optimal incentives looks like a scheme which rewards you for your own performance and punishes you when the performance of the other guys is high. So you are rewarded not only for your performance, but you're also rewarded for the difference between your performance and the performance of the other guys. Does it make sense? Again, you know, psychologically, you could be in a mild shock. You could say, why should I be punished by the performance of the other guys? But there is a very wise decision. Because if the performance of the other guys is also very high, right, it means that you've all experienced a powerful positive shock. Maybe the demand for the product has increased for some reason. Maybe the weather is good, whatever. Maybe the politics are good. Maybe you have higher demand because, I don't know, you're building shelters for refugees or whatever, right? So taking this information into account is useful. right? Whereas if, for instance, you have, the other agents perform not that well, and you also perform not that well, but still better than the rest, you should be rewarded for this. Remember the example I gave you about a car dealership in near Frankfurt. You know, after the financial crisis, the sales went down by, I don't remember, by, let's say, 30%, okay? So, in one of the dealership. But in the rest of the network, the sales went down by, let's say, 40%. The question is, should you give bonus to the people in that Frankfurt dealership or should you not? On the one hand, you shouldn't, because the sales went down by 30%. What bonus are you talking about? On the other hand, well, you should, because the performance in the other branches went down by 40%. So relative performance evaluation can be justified on the grounds of correlation between the shocks to your own performance and shocks to the performance of the other people. Even if the performance of the other people does not depend on your effort, even if the performance indicator I has nothing to do with your own effort, it may still contain useful information and in the form of a correlation between this other measure of performance and the shocks to your own performance. And using this correlation is the optimal thing to do in the design of incentives. So what do we learn about the informativeness principle? Two things. Well, first, you should use whatever indicators there are that have something to do with the agent's effort. This is example number one. And second, even if there are some indicators which have nothing to do with the agent's effort, but are correlated with the noise to the agent effort, you should use these indicators as well. Whether has nothing to do with the agent's effort. Should you use it or should you not use it? Yes, you should, if the weather is correlated with the shocks to the agent's own performance. If it is correlated, you should use this correlation in the optimal incentive design. If not, you should just leave the weather alone and base your incentives only on the one measure of performance that you started with. Does it make sense? Questions? Okay. So let's move on. We're now approaching sort of end of today's lecture, so maybe we'll finish a little bit earlier. And what I want to talk about for the rest of the lecture today is I want to talk about a situation in which the agent does more than one thing. Where are we? We have done the monitoring intensity principle, and we have, according to which the optimal strength of incentives and the optimal degree of precision with which performance is measured are simultaneously defined. We have gone through the informativeness principle, according to which you should use whatever information about the agent's effort that you could gather. As long as it's informative, in the sense of examples 1 and 2 that we have discussed. What we haven't done so far is, well, what we've done so far. What we've done so far is we have assumed that the agent exerts his effort only in one direction. So there's only one dimension of effort measured by E. So you can work harder or you can work less hard. You can put in more or less effort only in one direction of your work. That's not very realistic, because people are typically doing different jobs and spend their time, allocate their time between different activities doing the same job. This proverbial key account manager, whose example I gave you, right? What key account manager does? He spends effort in order to increase sales, so that's sales effort, but he also spends effort in the direction of customer acquisition. This effort does not necessarily immediately bring sales today, but it may be beneficial for the firm in terms of bringing sales tomorrow. The same key account manager also spends effort in cultivating customer relationships by providing better customer service. It may or may not be reflected in sales today, but it's an effort nevertheless. So, in a more realistic scenario, the same agent spends effort along various dimensions of effort. Not only do you spend effort to generate sales, you also spend effort to cultivate customer relationships. You also spend effort to acquire new customers. You also spend effort to learn new things about the market. You also spend effort in order to develop good relationships with suppliers, for instance, right? I spend my effort between doing research, doing teaching, well, very little effort I spend on doing teaching, and I also spend some effort on doing admin, and I allocate my effort between the different activities, right? So, which fact the models we use so far have not acknowledged. In the models we've used so far, effort was only unidimensional, but in fact, effort is multidimensional. So, how do we model the multidimensionality of effort? We model the multidimensionality of effort by allowing the agent to spend efforts on different activities. And the amounts of effort that the agents spend on different activities are denoted by E1, E2, E5, E10, whatever. If you have N activities, you will have different amounts of effort corresponding to each activity. So instead of allowing only for one effort, E, which we've done so far, we are working with more than one measures of effort, right? So, of course, effort is costly. And in this example, to make it simple, in this example, we assume that the costs of effort are a function of the sum of efforts along the various dimensions. It does not always have to be the case. There are more complicated models which relax this assumption, but for the purposes of this bachelor-level course, I think we're better off limiting ourselves to this relatively simple case. So here is two dimensions of effort. Let's say effort spent on sales and effort spent on customer service. And these are two measures of performance. These are the sales, which is a function of sales effort plus shock. And this is some kind of customer service measure, which is a measure of effort spent on customer service plus the shock specific to this measure. Okay. Now, the principal wants to reward both these activities. Why does the principal want to reward both these activities? Well, because the principal's profit is a function of both of these activities. The principal gets the profit not only from sales effort, but also from customer service effort. So the principal wants to offer beta 1 and beta 2 for performance measures Z1 and Z2. So how will then the agent's effort decision look like? The problem itself, the optimal design of incentives in this situation is rather complicated. You could do it at home if you are ambitious and interested and send me your results. I will put them on Ilias. But let's just scratch the surface of this problem. So, the agent's effort choice will maximize the certainty equivalent of the agent's net utility from exerting effort levels E1 and E2. If you take the first order conditions from this function, you will see that the marginal product of effort 1 should be equal to the marginal product of effort 2 and should be equal to the marginal costs of total effort. Now, with the marginal cost of total effort being the same by virtue of the costs of effort being specified as a function of as a sum of two effort, function of the sum of two effort, it turns out, if this is constant under a given level of effort, it turns out that the optimal strength of incentives should be the same along both dimensions of effort. In fact, the optimal strength of incentives should be the same along all dimensions of effort. In other words, you should be rewarded you should be rewarded exactly the same for all the dimensions in which you spend your effort. If you are not rewarded the same for all the dimensions in which you spend your effort, what you're going to do is you're going to switch your effort entirely to the dimensions for which you are rewarded relatively more and totally ignore the dimensions for which you're rewarded relatively less. A classical example here is teacher. So teachers, for a long, long time, there's been a talk, it still is ongoing, and there are people of different opinions on this matter. The matter is the following. Whether or not we should offer incentives to teachers at schools or universities. Well, basic economic theory says, of course we should offer incentives to teachers at schools and universities because, well, it says if you offer incentives, then teachers will increase their effort. When teachers increase their effort, the students will learn more and learn better. When students learn more and learn better, their human capital will increase. When human capital will increase, their productivity will increase, and our declining economy will grow, and we will all become richer, and good things are going to happen. This logic has some merit in it. You know, look at the basic incentives model, and you will see immediately what the argument is about. However, if you look at the empirical evidence, if you actually look at the experiments conducted in various places, mostly in the United States, but also sometimes in Europe, if you look at the experimental evidence on the effect of incentives specifically for teachers on student outcomes, you'll see that incentives for teachers have not improved student outcomes. Why not? Yeah, that's a possibility. And yes, there are a lot of intrinsically motivated teachers, but not all teachers are intrinsically motivated. And even even if you have intrinsic motivation, if you offer extrinsic motivation on top of intrinsic motivation, you should have at least in the short run some positive effect. When you withdraw monetary incentives, then things will get much worse. Remember this DC and Ryan work, right? Or early work. Intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation become problematic when you withdraw extrinsic incentives. Then you have less intrinsic motivation and performance falls down. But if you have a certain level of intrinsic motivation and you offer incentives, then people's effort will temporarily increase and their performance should increase. It doesn't. Yeah? So good point, but I don't think it offers the entire explanation to the problem. Another, the element of an explanation other than intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation that I want to talk about in relation to the equal compensation principle that we're doing now is, well, the multidimensionality of teachers' effort. What is it that teachers do, right? So teachers explain the material. Teachers try to develop skills that students will need to pass the test, right? So the teachers are motivated based on the test result performance. So typically what happens is, if your school improves its ranking in terms of some kind of end of the year student test, you will get a bonus of X euros or something like this, right? So, or you're going to get a bonus of X euros for every student that goes from your school to university rather than to, unskilled employment, something like that, right? Now, so when teachers' incentives are based on easily observable and well-measured outcomes, such as student test statistic, what's going to happen is that teachers will concentrate their efforts on making sure that the student test statistics look good. Right? But that's not, but teaching to the test is not the only thing that teachers do or supposed to do. Teachers also have to develop human capital in their students. They also have to develop understandings of the world. They also have to treat them as people and make sure that they are confident enough to to do well, not only academically, but also but also generally in life. Teachers, in other words, teachers transmit not only the technical test-related information, which is helpful to student for students to pass the test, but also they also transmit a lot of information which is less easily formalizable and less related to the test results on based on which teachers are rewarded. So to get back to the equal compensation principle, if you have the teaching to the test activity and human capital, the raising of human capital activity that teachers are doing, and if you only reward the teaching to the test activity and will not reward the human capital activity, what's going to happen is that, you know, if this is zero and this is not zero, then the optimal effort will change so that the effort from raising human capital will decrease, and the effort that teachers spend on teaching to the test will increase, right? So yes, the student tests will probably improve, and they often do, but if you look at long-term outcomes, such as the probability of employment, such as earnings later in life, such as health outcomes, etc., they are not affected. Why are they not affected? Well, because it's not only teaching to the test that's important. What's also important is the less well-measurable activities, such as the activities related to the formation of human capital of the teachers. That's why a lot of people in the incentives literature now become of an opinion that teachers should not be incentivized for their students passing the tests. Because what happens is when they are incentivized for their students passing the test, they withdraw effort from all other activities and only make sure that their students pass the test, and that's it. You understand the point? So if we incentivize, well, to give you another example, if we incentivize a professor for, you know, teaching students, right? A professor will work very hard and will improve their student evaluation results, but the other activity, such as research, will suffer as a result. Now, the equal compensation principle states that when you have more than one direction in which you can spend your effort, the marginal benefits of spending effort in either direction should be equal to each other, and they should be equal to the total marginal costs of effort. Okay, what does it mean? What often happens is you have pretty good measure of one type of activity and a pretty bad measure of another type of activity. Like with teachers, you have a pretty good measure of teaching to the test, student test results, and you have a pretty bad, noisy measure, if at all, for the teacher's activities towards raising human capital, towards nurturing human capital in their students. So you have the sigma squared 1, relatively low, and you have the sigma squared 2, relatively high. Now, when sigma squared 1 is relatively low, the optimal strength of incentives beta 1 should be relatively high. When sigma squared 2 is relatively high, the optimal strength of incentives beta 2 should be relatively low, we know that. But we also know that in the optimum, when agents does more than one dimension of activity, the marginal returns to these activities should be equal. So even though you can reward student test scores quite powerfully because the student test scores are quite well measured, you shouldn't reward teachers' performance on student test scores very highly. You should reward it just as much as you reward teachers' performance towards nurturing students' human capital, which is rewarded at zero marginal rate. That's why teacher incentives are not and shouldn't, in my opinion, be very widely practiced. So that finishes the sort of maths part of today's lecture. Let us wrap up and summarize. So what have we learned over the course of today's and last week's lecture? We've learned a lot about incentives. And I think we really capitalized on the knowledge of incentives that we acquired in the Personnel Economics 1 course in the winter semester. In Personnel Economics 1 course in the winter semester, we only touched on the situation when agents are not risk neutral. Here we really deepened into the issue of agents not being risk neutral, being not risk neutral. We have found that even when the agent is not risk neutral, incentives still work because they give the not zero, the above zero marginal product of effort, which means that the optimal effort should be above zero. We've also learned about the such things as strength of incentives. And we've also learned, more importantly, that the strength of incentives is a function of things like risk aversion, costs of effort, and the precision of the measure with which you measure performance. So for the people for whom costs of effort are high, the optimal incentives should be low. You shouldn't hire these people because they're going to be useless, with or without incentives. For the people who are very risk averse, the optimal incentives again should be low. Why? Because for them, the costs of bearing risk are very high, and therefore the trade-off between risk and incentives should be more towards insurance rather than strong incentives. And you know what we spoke about today, we were talking about sigma squared a lot, and what we've learned is that when you can't measure performance very well, when sigma squared is very high, you should not offer strong incentives. What we've also learned, and more interesting than this, is that the optimal strength of incentives and the optimal precision or imprecision with which you measure performance are in fact simultaneously determined. Look at the measurement intensity principle, the first part of today's lecture. What we've also learned is that when you have other measures of performance which are informative in a certain mathematical sense of the agent's effort, you should use these measures with, and you should devise incentive schemes so that the strength of incentives offered for a particular measure of performance is proportionate to the degree of precision with which this measure is informative of the agent's effort. We've also learned that even if you have measures which have nothing to do with the agent's effort but are nevertheless correlated with the shocks to the agent's effort, you should use this information as well. So in rewarding an ice cream salesperson, you should use information about the weather. And in rewarding, in deciding whether to give a bonus to one particular team, you should use information about the performance of other teams, because all these performances are likely to be affected by common shocks. And finally, what we've learned as well is that if the effort exerted by the agent is multidimensional, so that you do sales, customer service, not only sales, then the optimal strength of incentives should satisfy the so-called equal compensation principle, namely that the marginal reward, the optimal strength of incentives for all dimensions of activity should be the same. One implication is that if one particular relevant activity is not very well measured, then it doesn't matter how well the other dimensions are measured, your optimal strength of incentives should be not very high. So all these three principles that we learned today, they tell us is that even though the linear incentives when agents are not risk neutral are fundamentally inefficient, you can try and improve their efficiency by using information in a clever way, by measuring relevant aspects of the agent's performance in a clever way. So incentives are cool. Not all firms practice incentives, and for the reasons that we explained last week and today, namely the equal compensation principle. Sometimes the performance is so multidimensional that you cannot prioritize one measure of performance over the others. So not all firms practice very strong incentives. That sort of makes sense. Are there any other ways in which monetary incentive, in which people can be incentivized? Yes, there are other ways. Are there any negative effects of incentives? Oh, yes, there are. Of these effects, we will talk next time. Before I totally finish, let me quickly go through the suggested practice question. Suggested practice questions, as usual and in general, apply to every lecture on this course. Try to replicate the results on the slides. Just write down the model, specify the first order conditions, derive the optimal effort, optimal strengths of incentives for every slide. This is excellent training for the exam. So, because this advice is general, I do not even put it here in the practice question slide. But in particular, if you're ambitious, try to do the following. And you will learn about the beauty of Taylor expansion in the process. This is really great fun. As another practice question, try to derive the optimal risk distribution rule, the optimal risk distribution result, in the which was featured in the last week's lecture. So, also try to play with the monitoring intensity principle by solving for the optimal strength of incentives and the optimal precision with which you measure performance under different scenarios with respect to the productivity of effort and the costs of effort. You could do it either analytically or, even better, you can do it graphically. Again, great fun. Now, the very last thing I would like to say is thank you to Caroline for working out the derivation of one of the results in the authority lecture, namely the difference between the total welfare under employment contract and under the sales contract, which I will maybe upload to the course website towards the end of the course after making sure that this derivation is correct. If people want to contribute to the learning environment of this course by deriving some results which they think are hard, they are welcome to do so. Just write down your derivations, probably in LaTeX, send me the file, I will vet through them, and if they're good enough, I will upload them to the file. This is an excellent way of leaving a lasting impression on me, and more importantly, of helping your fellow students on this course. Thank you very much. See you next time.